Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Hello and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, for this half-hour journey through culinary history. And it's hard to believe, but 50 years ago this month was the first publication of Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Hard to believe because, you know, it just, first of all, for some people say, I mean, it's only been 50 years because it's always on our shelves. We're always referring to it. And then again, for those of us who remember, we say, oh my God, it's been 50 years. And last night I had the opportunity to go to a wonderful panel discussion in celebration of the 50 years of this publication, and it included such luminaries as Judith Jones, who was the editor credited with bringing her book to print, and Jeffrey Drummond, who was one of her early producers on television, as well as people who have written biographies of her, Laura Shapiro, Dana Paulin. And it was just a wonderful celebration of Julia Child and the book. And during the entire panel presentation, there was a large screen off to one side, and old segments of her series, The French Chef, were being played throughout this panel discussion, obviously without sound, but everyone was mimicking her voice anyway. Ooh, you know, she had such a wonderful voice to replicate. Throughout the show, throughout the panel discussion, in every segment that showed on that large screen, there was always a glass of wine on her cooking counter, or when she took the food into the dining room, as she sat down to the table, there was her glass of wine. Because for Julia, of course, you couldn't have a meal, a proper meal, without a glass of wine, and the two complemented each other. And my guest today will help, I guess, illustrate why that is so important, and tell us a little bit about American wines, and why there was for a long time this disconnect, because Julia Child really brought that back to us and said, this is how you should have dinner. This is what you should eat and drink with dinner. My guests today are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, the authors of so many wonderful books, and their newest book is called The Food Lover's Guide to Wine, but their other books are What to Drink with What You Eat, The Flavor Bible, which I love, Flavor Bible, which is a Bible, Becoming a Chef, The New American Chef. So many books. And I welcome them today to talk specifically about their new book, but also about American wine, because it has a history that a lot of us are not aware of. So welcome, Karen and Andrew.
Well, thanks so much for having us, Linda.
Thank you.
All right, tell me, why do you think there was, as I said, this disconnect between Americans and wine? It really didn't become part of our dinner table for many years.
Well, it's so interesting. I'm so glad that you said what you said about Julia Child, because in some ways she was really such an important inspiration for The Food Lover's Guide to Wine. In her book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, mm-hmm. back in 1961, she matched a wine recommendation for every entree recipe featured
That's
in
right.
the book. And when you think about it today, I mean, we mentioned, look through whether it's Rachel Ray's books or the Gourmet Cookbook or Mark Bittman's books or any of those, you know, great massive tomes that, you know, are loaded with hundreds, if not thousands, of recipes, you won't find, you know, scarcely a word about wine pairing and what to pair with what recipes. And in some cases, you'll only find a handful or fewer recipes that even call for wine as an ingredient. So I think what is so interesting that's changed since 1961, since Julia, was that the world of wine has become so much more complicated. A lot of those recommendations in her book were for Burgundy or Bordeaux or Rhone wines at that point in time. Now, you know, we're at a point where go to any corner wine store and you can find wines literally from all over the world available, right? And from all 50 states for that matter, which we have available now. So it's become much more complicated. And cookbook authors tend not to write about wine, and wine authors tend not to write about food too much.
But it really vanished. I mean, it was not vanished. It just really wasn't part of the American dinner table. And that, you know, that's kind of, I can't quite figure that out. I don't know if it's Americans' puritanical ways or Prohibition really put a, you know, a nail in the coffin. I don't
or what it was. Great marketing on the part of Coca-Cola and Pepsi, because actually, if you look at the statistics, the number one beverage that is drunk with the evening meal at an American dinner table is a soda.
Interesting.
Coke, Pepsi, 7-Up, you name it. Yeah. And it's sad, because there are so many other beverages that are such better complements to the flavor of food. And if you take a little bit of time to think about those beverages, and we happen to think wine is the single best, you can have so much, you know, so much better of more extraordinary of an experience. And it's not hard. It's complicated. It's overwhelming in some cases to Americans to figure out what am I going to pair with what I'm going to have to eat tonight. But it can be done.
Well, Andrew is Karen. I might add, Karen is you have quite an illustrious background with all your degrees and education, and really I can see delving into the research of all your books quite well. And Andrew, you've got the credibility of, you've been there on the front line. You were a former chef and trained with Madeline Kamen.
Yes, I trained with Madeline, okay. And actually went to the School for American Chefs in Napa Valley. And it was a really incredible experience, because here you are with this living legend, Madeline Kamen, and we were situated at Beringer Vineyards for 2 weeks. So we're literally right at the vineyard cooking, we're going out to the farms and shopping. And the fun experiment was every day we'd take a Beringer wine, naturally, and we'd taste it, and they'd say, okay, how are we going to cook for this wine? And really bridged the two and learned a lot of the
tricks. Not what we're going to match with our dinner, but how we're going to cook for this wine. Interesting.
Right. And it was a good exercise, because the chefs were all acid freaks. We want to add vinegar and balsamic and, you know, and Thai chilies and things like that. And it was nice to sit there and say, wow, how can I celebrate this wine? And we actually did that a lot for when we worked for the Washington Post for 2 years and really focused on food and wine pairing. We actually came out in our first column and said, we love food first, and we love the fact that wine makes food taste even better, and vice versa. And so we really do live for the synergy of the beverages.
Well, it's interesting, because Europeans, this has been their way of life for thousands of years.
Exactly.
And, you know, you don't find them drinking wine as an aperitif or as a cocktail. Wine is meant to go with food.
And but they think of wine as food.
As food, right. Yeah. You have your wine with food, you have your food with wine.
Exactly.
You know, in America, it was so slow. I mean, okay, we're a young country, okay, but very slow to come around about this. And yet, there's quite a history of American wine. And it's funny, because if you say to someone something about wine, you go, oh, French wine, yes. Oh, Italian wine, yes.
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 You don't say American wine. You say, oh, Californian wine. You know, it's funny. American wine doesn't have quite the panache that saying, you know, wines from other countries have. And I think that we're trying to overcome
now, I think that's changed so much. Yeah. I think the real issue that got Andrew and I going about this book is the fact that when you think of wine, as you're saying, you know, you think of France first, you think of Italy first, before you would think of the United States. And the fact is that America does have this very storied history when it comes to wine. In fact, that's one of the reasons that the United States was founded back when the settlers came over to Jamestown back in the early 1600s. It was with the primary intent of establishing wine-growing region that would produce wine that would prevent England from having to buy its wine at high prices from France and Spain. And so that is really one of the founding reasons that we're here today. And, you know, back in the 1700s, Ben Franklin was, you know, sharing his winemaking knowledge, which at that point in time, you know, for over 100 years, the settlers had been commanded by the king to
actually plant vines,
plant vines and make wine.
Huh. Interesting. And yet Virginia never really became a big, a well-known
wine producer. It just took a long time. I think this is very funny. I mean, you're saying, like, where's the disconnect? And that is a good question, because Virginia now, they celebrated the 400th anniversary of Jamestown, and the Queen came over from England, and now we have 119 vineyards in Virginia. So Virginia is actually one of the top five states in the
United States for wine producing. But back in those early days, you know, right after the 1600s when the settlers came over, the vines were largely wiped out by phylloxera and by other diseases, and they couldn't get the right match of the right grape with the right ground, which is what it's all about. So it took a lot of time for the United States for things to kick off. And, of course, you know, Virginia now, of course, they're producing some really world-class wines, truly. But I think we had a much better luck out in California when the vines got planted and wines started being made that were catching
Right, and
the
they were marketed
attention.
Well. And, of course, then when they had the blind tasting with the, you know, the French, you know, voted California wines to be even better.
The Big Judgment of Paris, 1976. But, you know, it's funny because American wines were winning world wine awards even before 1976. A lot of people think, well, that is really what put American wines on the map. But it's not true. If you look back 100 years before that, there was a Virginia wine that was named the best red wine in the world. And it was made from the Norton grape, which is indigenous to the United States. And, you know, lo and behold, we're winning these wine competitions. But it took a lot of time because America has this, you know, love-hate relationship with wine. You know, we went through Prohibition, which basically almost, you know, wiped out wine from the United States, very sadly. But we came back from that. We corrected our ways and realized, you know, and before Prohibition, truly, there were a lot of alcohol-related deaths, people overindulging. And so Prohibition did prevent a lot of those deaths. But once people learned moderation and realized, hey, this is just something that you can drink with dinner and enjoy in moderation, now the United States government is actually, when it releases its annual dietary guidelines for Americans every 5 years, the 2010, which are the most recent guidelines that were issued, recommend that people drink a glass of wine a day, or two for men, because it helps, you know, in terms of heart disease, in terms of weight control. There's lots of benefits for drinking wine.
Exactly. I mean, the health benefits, I think we all, you know, have had that driven home, that the health benefits of wine in moderation. Mm-hmm. And back to Julia Child, everything in moderation.
Absolutely.
Even moderation.
That's right. I think the key, and you mentioned, is drinking the wine again. Once again, drinking wine with food, or eating dinner with wine,
right?
And that, you know, that certainly makes a huge difference. And we all know about Thomas Jefferson and how he was such a proponent of fine wines and fine food. And so as America's history went on, we found ourselves with wine developing in a lot of other states as well. Right.
Yes, I think it was as of 2002, North Dakota was the last person to start growing grapes.
So North Dakota.
The last state.
Last state, yes.
Can they grow wine? I mean, ice wine.
Yes. I don't think we've tasted too many from North Dakota.
No, I don't know how widely distributed they are. But it's funny, again, you know, New York State was also producing wine in the early, mid-1800s. So again, it went sort of things of California and then maybe Oregon. It's like, oh, we've had a lot of beachheads all around the country producing wine, and very good wine. The Finger Lakes are some of the best wines in the country right now, certainly the Rieslings that are coming out. So I think it's a matter of Americans knowing what grape to grow. You know, you have to find the right grape. I mean, it's not like France invented the whole thing overnight. They took hundreds of years to find the right soil, the right grape for the right soil, and that sort of thing.
That's right. And then getting back to the fact that we're a very young country, and understanding you can't do everything all at once, right?
Yes.
And getting to know that there's regionality. There's, as you say, plant the right grape for the right terroir. You know, I was at some food gathering in Rhode Island one time, and someone was, we said, we're going for a champagne tasting, or, you know, a sparkling wine taste, excuse me, can't call it champagne, right?
That's okay,
and
it slips sometimes too.
And I said, really, you grow that and make that here? They said, well, as a matter of fact, we have the exact same climate. We're along the river. We're up the hills. We've got the same breezes, the same climate as, and then, you know, named a couple of areas of France. So it's just knowing, I guess, knowing the area, knowing what you can grow.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's amazing. You can even get wonderful sparkling wine in Santa Fe, of all places. Mm. Gruet is a wonderful French-owned winery that started in New Mexico and is producing, you know, really phenomenal deals, phenomenal value with through the Champagne method. But, of course, they can't call it Champagne because it's not made in the Champagne region of France. So, but you know, if you go to Long Island, you can go out to Wolfer Estate is making wonderful sparkling wines.
And the Finger Lakes, I mean, they're, you know, very
and they're doing some great sparkling Rieslings up in the Finger Lakes as well.
Yeah. It's interesting that this different states, as I say, we you know, still think of, I think a lot of people aren't letting themselves be adventurous in the American wines that they do choose. I mean, yes, it's
sure.
If it comes from Oregon, okay, that's fine. Let's have a Pinot Noir from Oregon, you know, or California. Well, of course, then California wines became kind of priced out of the market too, and back to buying French wine. So,
or wine anywhere where there's a glut of wines, where there's, you know, much more production, you can find some deals. So there are definitely deals from different parts of the world right now, and it's good to kind of look outside. I mean, Napa has become a world-class wine-producing region.
Right.
It's so well-known that the, you know, they can charge and get the kind of prices that you used to only see Burgundies and Bordeaux priced at. But now I think it's a fascinating time to get to really celebrate wines from all over the world. I think what's hard for Americans is that they don't know how to pronounce them, quite frankly, because
That's right. Think
about all these grape names and all these, you know, most Americans do not speak a second language, and when you enter the world of wine, you know, Chardonnay, Cabernet, those are easy to pronounce, so people tend to order them. Those are the you know, biggest selling wines around.
That's interesting.
But when you get into Moscofilaro or all these other, you know, interesting grape names, it's a little tougher. So.
I'll take number 382 on the wine list.
Right.
Or when you're presented with a wine list that is this, you know, daunting tome of 500 different wines. I mean, it's intimidating to many people.
And that's when you turn to the sommelier and you delicately, you know, point to a price point that you're looking for and have them make a recommendation. I think
you brought up an interesting point. What we're going to do is take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the sommelier and about the new book. Okay, so stay tuned. Hi, welcome back. We are talking with Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, the authors of the newly minted Food Lover's Guide to Wine. And I have to say that just got my hands on the book. It was just released, what, yesterday, day before yesterday?
Literally, the hard copies just came out.
Yeah. And I have to say, I was expecting, okay, you know, another big wine book and have to plod through. We were just talking about long wine lists. I think, okay, a wine book, am I going to be able to get through this and think of some questions to ask? It's not that at all. I love this book. It's like a kind of like an encyclopedia, but as I said earlier, it's a user-friendly encyclopedia. It's got you can just leaf to, or you know, just pull up in any section, and all of a sudden you've got a different list and a different explanation. And Andrew, you were just talking about the time to ask a sommelier. You even have a section on sommeliers and how to deal with them, and you list some of the best-known sommeliers and their backgrounds. Tell us a little bit about that. When should one consult a sommelier? Well, of course, depending on if you're a restaurant that has a sommelier.
True. It depends, again, whether, yes, if it, has a, even if they don't have a sommelier, they might have someone who really knows something about wine. I think the most important thing is to be inquisitive and ask a question so you don't... Sommelier's Pet Peeves is actually a little section of the book where you don't order another Cabernet or Chardonnay. Find the wine person who's into wine at the restaurant, if they do have a sommelier or not, and then say, I want to try something new. I always, and then say exactly what you typically drink. And again, if you don't want to, if you want to be delicate, simply just point to the price and say, I'm looking for something in this range.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will find something for you. And if you don't like it, let them know, because they'll find something else for you. That's the most important thing to also remember. Is you don't have to love their recommendation. You probably will. But... you know, don't hesitate to say it's a little too this or that for me, because they will then go pour it for the staff and have a tasting and then find something else for you. But really, we found that, as Karen coined the phrase, she thinks sommeliers are going to be the new rock stars. And I think it's actually true.
I think it's their time, right? Yeah. Well, how, I mean, you wrote about, you know, becoming a chef and the flavor Bible, and then, yes, then you got into the wine with what to drink with what you eat. What inspired you to really, well, I know, Andrew, you spent time, as you say, at the Beringer Vineyards, and that, you know, ignited something, you know, mm-hmm. about wanting to know more about wines. So how did you decide to write a couple books about wine, and then this particularly?
Well, you know, it was the most natural progression in the world. We never said that we were going to set out to become wine writers, to write books about wine, but there's this great quote that opens chapter one in the book, and it's from Alice Waters and Paul Bertoli from their book, Chez Panisse Cooking. And the quote is that, although consumed as a beverage, wine is also like a sauce that accents and enhances flavor in food.
Mm.
And when you really take that to heart, you realize that if you truly care about food and you care about flavor, then why would you just care about what's on the plate in front of you without giving equal regard to what's in the glass? Because when you're consuming those two things together, they're really going to influence the flavor of one another, as well as your overall flavor experience. So that was what led to us to explore it in more detail in our book, What to Drink with What You Eat.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of our newest book, we really wanted to delve into the flavor of the wine itself, because I think most Americans are really overwhelmed. You know, we profile over 250 different wines in the Food Lover's Guide to Wine, and it tells you what the characteristic flavor profiles you might expect of a particular wine are. So if you're not sure you want to venture too far away from Chardonnay, we'll tell you what wines taste like Chardonnay.
Right.
If you want to stick closer,
I like that.
To something
and you
else.
Even have some price level categories too,
yes.
Which if people are a little concerned, because I mean, no chef wants a diner to drink a bad cheap wine with a wonderful meal that he or she has slaved over. So, you know, once again, going back to the sommelier, you want to, you know, maybe recommend something, even if you can't afford that, you know, wonderful, you know, $300 Margaux.
Well,
you know, there's something else you can drink.
I would say, having had the luxury of tasting some very expensive wines, I don't think that quality and price are always correlated.
Mm.
I think you can get, we have a list in the back of the book of 150 wines under $15, any of which I would be happier to drink with any meal, any day of the week than a Coke or a Pepsi.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't have to be expensive. If you think of a can of Coke costing $1 and, you know, we've got bottles of wine in the book that are recommended for $7, you know, that's less than $2 a serving versus a can of Coke. Yeah, you're paying, you know, a little bit more, but your quality of that experience, your quality of life is so much better.
Right. Well, I know, and I think... I don't know if it's actually activated here in New York, but a new law was passed that if you don't finish a bottle of wine at a restaurant at dinner,
you can take it
with you now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's wonderful.
It never happens to me.
I don't have that problem either.
But I think that, too, is something that encourages more people, particularly Americans, to order that bottle of wine, you know, if they were afraid, well, I'm not going to be able to drink a whole bottle of wine at dinner, you know.
Sure.
They can take it with them. You know, we were talking about the history of American wines, and... it was really, as far as wine production, yes, there were vineyards planted all over the place, but I was really interested to note that you said that really the first commercial vineyard, and I mean, it's different to plant a vineyard, especially like you can plant vineyards in your backyard, or, you know, mm-hmm. your back 30 acres or whatever, but the first commercial vineyard was not planted until 1857, or not planted, but got going, you know, the commercialization of producing that wine until 1857 in America. I mean, good heavens, that's, you know, that wine's not even ready to drink yet, right?
Well, that's the other big myth about aging wines. You know, a lot of Americans think, oh, you know, Burgundy, Bordeaux, you need to age it for so long. You know, wine is meant to be aged. The truth is that 99% of the wine that's produced in the world today is meant to be drunk within the year. And so you want to drink wines young and fresh for the most part. And that's something else we're still learning. Uh-huh. As Americans. And we do have guidelines in the book about how long you might want to age a wine, because it differs. Reds, you typically might want to age a very big tannic Cabernet longer than you would something that's meant to be drunk really young and fresh, right. Like an Italian Prosecco or something right. Like that.
Well, that brings me to a page that your publisher put out, or the publicist put out on some of the myths that you, and we love busting myths on the show, but some of the myths that put a rest to. And one that I caught before I even saw this list, I caught it when I was reading, I guess, one of the, in the beginning of the book or the blurb, is that a lot of people associate wine buying with men, and they think that men are the purchasers. Tell me a little bit about that. That's interesting.
Oh, well, we were happy to include this great quote that there was a study done that the New York Times ran back in 2005, and it was that contrary to wine's male image, women buy 77% and consume 60% of the wine in America. Yeah. So, in fact, you'll go through the pages of the book, and we've got lots of female faces, great sommeliers like Belinda Chang, who just won the James Beard Award as best sommelier in America, Claire Popper,
Emily Perrier,
Emily
Fiore.
Yes,
we have a lot of great women sommeliers, and it's nice because they have so much passion, and they're not all caught up in, you know, the classifications of Bordeaux or anything like that. They just want to. There's hedonist. That's the best thing about
they
it.
They want you to drink something good with your meal.
They want to pull out something really cool that you've never had and set your world afire.
Yeah, Karen, you mentioned that people think that, you know, it has to be an old wine to. I think Steve Martin had that great line in his one of his movies, The Jerk, I think. And the waiter brings out this wonderful wine with all this flourish. It's a very nice aged French wine. He goes, "What? Why would I want to drink this old wine? Bring me some fresh wine." Everyone laughed
love
about
Steve Martin.
But I love the fact that you do say that it doesn't have to be, you know, an old rare wine to really taste good. Another myth that was brought up in that was that you really can't judge wine until you're properly educated in wine and take a wine course, or, you know, as Andrew, as you did, go, you know, study at a, you know, with someone at a vineyard. So
true. You know, we go to cocktail parties, and sometimes we're introduced as food authors. We write about food. People take a step closer to us, and they're really, oh, we'd like to talk to you about that. When we're introduced as wine authors, people take a step back.
they hide their glass.
Right? Well, and they apologize. They're like, I don't know anything about wine. I'm sorry. Or it was like, well, you never drink wine? Oh, yeah. Well, I know what I like to drink. Well, then you have a palate. You have taste. You know what you like to drink. That's the start of a conversation. I think people in America still feel too intimidated today to really let themselves enjoy wine and get great pleasure from wine.
And have conviction of their own taste.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what you like.
It's as simple as that. You don't need to be rereading all the critics or anything like that. And again, that's what we try to make it very accessible. When in our chapter 4, we list the grapes and the styles of wine and give you a flavor profile. And so if someone says, I don't know what I like, it's like, well, do you like the taste of strawberries or cherries? It's like, well, I do like that. It's like, well, you're going to like a glass of rosé. And rosé is not white Zinfandel. Rosé is dry and wonderful.
Yeah, interesting. We, in the research for this book, must have been a lot of fun. Well, I think it was, to me, it seems daunting as well. But what were some of the biggest challenges to you when you were trying to put this together?
Well, the single biggest challenge is the more research, quote unquote, we do, the less capacity we have to do research. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we learn to spit.
Yeah.
I think that's why professional wine drinkers and critics and writers, we have
don't
a spit
swallow.
Bucket nearby, and we use it religiously because, we've had the pleasure of tasting, you know, hundreds of different wine grapes and wine styles from around the world. But I think when you taste as many as we do, you can't swallow them all. Right.
Well, and then to have to call that list into something manageable that you can really put in a book. I mean, it's you know, picking and choosing.
And it's, I mean, this is the book that we wanted as wine writers, as wine lovers. This is the book we wanted to have, and since it didn't exist, this is why we wrote it. You know, we wanted to know how to pronounce wines so we wouldn't be embarrassed by mispronouncing them. So all the wine descriptions start out with pronunciations. We give the flavor profiles. Are they light-bodied, full-bodied, you know, high in tannin, low in tannin, high in acid, low in acid, and what to eat with it, of course, because that's what it's all about.
That's
it's
right.
There
that's
to
right.
make the food taste better.
Well, you were wine columns. I'm sorry, Andrew, you had mentioned that you were wine columnist for
the Washington Post.
Washington Post for, you know, several years. Yeah. So, I mean, you really, it was your obligation, I guess you could say, to, you know, to educate people and tell them what to drink. And with this book, you really have, I mean, you've kind of done that in spades. I mean, I think it's anyone who looks through this book will feel comfortable, I think, in once again, with their own tastes and going out and ordering something. Well, the authors of this book told me.
That's absolutely our goal. So yeah, I really hope that that is the case. We want people to enjoy life. And we think a big part of enjoying life is enjoying food, of course, but food and wine together.
Right. And I think understanding that and understanding the history of America, you know, American wines and how new Americans are to this, hard to say, but you know, the Americans are, but it's true.
Yes.
How new they are to, you know, to accepting wine as a food, as you say. And I recommend this, The Food Lover's Guide to Wine. And Andrew Dernenberg and Karen Page, it has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is ours.
I wish you all the luck with this.
Thank you so much, Linda.
And thank you for listening once again. I'm Linda Palacio, and this has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event.